Today at Reader's Corner, Eliza Griswold, author of The Tenth Parallel, dispatches from the fault line between Christianity and Islam.
This is a story about Christians and Muslims trying to work out their differences in the face of global and economic pressures. Ethnicity, race, state, all of these come second now to the idea of, am I a Christian or am I a Muslim? That understanding of God's will and living God's will is a key to the solution of how people will coexist and how they will share limited resources.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. A daily battle is raging along the 10th parallel, the line of latitude 700 miles north of the equator in Africa and Southeast Asia, where Islam and Christianity intersect. In this critical geographical band, religious ideologies clash, often erupting into deadly violence, as more than half the world's Muslims and 60% of the world's Christians compete for the souls of the region's burgeoning population. Today's guest, award-winning journalist Eliza Griswold, spent 7 years traveling throughout this region, researching places like Somalia, Nigeria, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, where Christianity and Islam collide. The result is the book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. It's now out in paperback. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Ms. Griswold, the daughter of the former presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. She is currently a Guggenheim Fellow and reports on religion, conflict, and human rights. Ms. Griswold received the Anthony J. Lucas Prize for The Tenth Parallel. She also received a 2010 Rome Prize from the American Academy in Rome for her poetry. Ms. Griswold joined us by phone for this interview. Eliza Griswold, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
So where'd you get this idea? This is a pretty dangerous idea to be trotting across the globe in these regions. How'd this come about?
Well, it came about because I was well aware as a journalist working in Africa and Asia, especially after 9/11, that there was a geographic reality on the ground where Christianity and Islam actually met. And it wasn't, we hear so much about the Middle East in terms of Islam, but the truth is that 4 out of 5 of the world's nearly 2 billion Muslims don't live in the Middle East. They live in Africa and they live in Asia. And here on the ground is where they meet with more than half of the world's 2 billion Christians. So I wanted to travel where the two actually came into touch with one another.
One of the things that you tell us in this book, and frankly, it was an eye-opener for me, is the role that evangelical Christians from other parts of the globe, like America, play in proselytizing. And, you know, I always had this kind of vague and naive notion that those priests that would come and speak at Mass every summer from other parts of the world were really trying to reach out to heathens who had no religion. And what I'm learning in your book is that in many cases, it's the Christians trying to convert the Muslims. How does this fit in 2012? Is there increasing proselytizing among Christians coming from other places, especially America, into this 10th parallel? Or is it just the fact that the population's growing and obviously there's more attention to it?
Well, you know, there's no one kind of Christianity along this line as in the rest of the world. And there's certainly no one kind of missionary activity either. And I just want to start by saying that in my experience of every kind of missionary, every kind of Christian missionary, those on the ground are doing basically aid work most of the time, and they're profoundly impacted by the people they meet. And although their intention, you know, I mean, you mentioned Mass, and certainly from a Catholic point of view, the idea of converting Muslims to Christianity would not be, proselytization looks nothing like that. And the truth is that in most of the places that I travel as a journalist in Africa, and that's for this book and outside of this book too, as in Eastern Congo, it's really the old school Catholics who are doing the best of the aid work, who have been there the longest, who understand what's going on, who have the most impartial view of things. So just to say that clearly, and you know, for evangelical Christians today, and this is certainly not just true today, this has been true for at least 100 years, part of the mission of being a believer is to carry the message. Now, that doesn't mean forcing anyone to convert, but that does mean sharing the understanding that Jesus Christ is the only way to come to God. And the idea of proselytizing is to share that message. It doesn't matter whether or not the person you're talking to converts to your religion. The emphasis is on preaching. So that's certainly true. But there are very, very many countries in the world, Muslim countries primarily, that are called closed countries. They're countries where Christian missionaries are not welcome to do their work. And in many of those countries, Christian missionaries do go and do use what they call creative access, which is essentially running a business or a medical endeavor, which gives people the right to be there, when in fact their real understanding of why they're there is to spread the word of God.
But that's a really important point you make about aid, because I think simplistically we could look at this solely in terms of converting someone to the real Jesus Christ. But what you're pointing out here is that these missionaries are lifting people out of poverty, and there's obviously more than one objective as far as the people are concerned. They see this opportunity, I suppose, to be lifted up by these missionaries.
Yeah, poverty and war. I mean, in many of the places that I've been in the world where there are no other aid groups at all, where no one is attending to the needs of either those who are starving or those who've been driven out of their homes by rural groups, the people who I run into are Christian groups providing tents, providing food. And that, especially as we see, one of the trends that's happening along the 10th parallel is that many of the states in Africa in particular were never really functioning governments. They were weak post-colonial regimes that where the governments have largely failed their people. Like, for example, if you take Nigeria, which was split in half by the 10th parallel, right? The north of Nigeria is primarily Muslim, and the south of Nigeria is Christian primarily, and that jigs and jags a little bit, but it's generally true. So the government of Nigeria has embezzled between $4 and $8 billion a year from its own people, although Nigeria is America's fifth largest oil supplier. So the majority of Nigerians live on less than a dollar a day. So for them, the government is at best absent, at worst rapacious. You know, to be a Nigerian, to be a citizen of Nigeria, you don't get education, you don't get a road, you don't get clean water, you don't get electricity. So people start to turn to other kinds of identity. Like if being a Nigerian means nothing, well, what does mean something? Well, being a Christian or being a Muslim, that kind of communal identity starts to represent people's rights, and they start to cling to one another in that way, in terms of religion, rather than, say, even ethnicity. Ethnicity, race, state, all of these come second now to the idea of, am I a Christian or am I a Muslim, along the 10th parallel.
And I understand from reading your book that when, let's just focus on the Christians for a moment, when they move into an area like Nigeria, they're going to preach a gospel of prosperity, which must work for people who are living on less than a dollar a day. But that gospel of prosperity is not going to work in the long run for everybody. So how is Christianity sustained then when all of a sudden, a few years later, somebody wakes up and realizes that prosperity still hasn't arrived, even though the Christian missionaries have?
Well, you know, I mean, I think one important point is that for most African Christians, they would say, in hearing this, they'd say, you know what? Our faith has nothing to do with missionaries. You know, an African understanding of Christianity puts the arrival of Christianity in Africa in 37 AD, 4 years after Jesus' death. And the story that many African Christians like to tell is the conversion in Jerusalem of a Sudanese eunuch. Now, the word Sudan, like the word Ethiopia, just means black, right? That's it. So the idea is people from the land of the blacks, people from sub-Saharan Africa, were in the Bible. Now, one of the first converts is this Sudanese eunuch who had come from Africa and was working in the court of an Ethiopian queen. And he goes to Jerusalem, and according to the book of Acts, the Apostle Philip sees him in the back of a chariot, kind of puzzling through the words of the scripture and not knowing what he's reading. And according to the book of Acts, what happens is the Holy Spirit says to Philip, go ask that man what he's reading. And so Philip approaches the eunuch and he converts him to Christianity. Well, he baptizes him in a roadside river. Now, following that, the African tradition holds that that eunuch returned to Africa and the seeds of Christianity were sown then. That's a really important idea now because it's not so much that missionaries have affected Christianity in Africa. It's that Christianity has become a form for many Africans of identity and self-determination. And you mentioned the prosperity gospel. That's absolutely true, that it is a notion very widely held among African Christians, as it is among Americans, that if God is really your father, what kind of God wants his children to be poor? So I don't think that understanding doesn't die out after a few years. It has a much longer lifespan. And that prosperity gospel actually changes people's lives because it's not just about like, oh, God's going to make me rich. It's also about health and hygiene. So it actually does have huge social ramifications in remaking what it means to be a believer in Africa today.
You're listening to Eliza Griswold. She is the author of The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. You talk about a network of Christian churches that dates back 100 years to a missionary named Herman Kumm. Tell us a little bit about his work, because this guy seems to get right to the point of this clash between Islam and Christianity in the sense that his goal was to stop Islam spread in Africa?
Exactly right. He actually went by Carl. Carl Kumm was a missionary who believed, and part of why I wrote about this is the idea of Islam and Christianity in some inexorable clash is hardly new. For a branch of Christianity, it's been true for at least 100 years. And Carl Kumm was one of these early believers who thought in Africa in particular that Africa was either going to fall under the crescent or the sword. So his understanding was that Islam spread violently over the northernmost third of the continent and that Islam was going to try to win Africa and that he, as a true Christian, needed to build a series of missionary fortresses, military installations across the southern edge of the Muslim world. That is the 10th parallel. And that's a geographic reality because two kinds of land meet along the 10th parallel across most of inland Africa. And this is both the dry north of Africa meets the wet sub-Saharan south here. So essentially, Islam arrived in Africa throughout the 1800s. Muslim missionaries and traders were carrying the faith south on trade routes. They got as far south as the 10th parallel, and there began the jungle. And where the jungle began, so did tsetse flies. And tsetse flies carried sleeping sickness. And so for all practical purposes, this is where Islam stopped its southern spread. Well, by the 1900s, Carl Kumm had identified that this fault line, this was the southern edge of Islam, and this is where he would build his at least 100 forts to stop Muslims from traveling any farther south into Africa. And he got quite a bit of support behind him. He actually tried to march across the 10th parallel to do kind of an exposition of where he would put these forts. And he had to swim, actually, because most of what along this fault line, the reason that Islam didn't spread farther is also because there's a swamp. There's a giant swamp in Sudan called the Sud. And so when Kumm hit that, he ran into some trouble, but he did survive it. And he did really foment this idea, both in America and Britain, that Christianity had to win Africa over Islam.
You know, I'm fascinated by the fact that you talk about the Muslim North and the Christian South. And I think you make reference somewhere in the book to the role that climate is playing in that regard today because of the arid nature of Northern Africa, and it's actually moving southward. Is that correct?
That's correct. What's happening along this zone, so it's not just the 10th parallel, which is the line of latitude 700 miles to the north of the equator. It's really the band along the equator. And here's what's happening along the equator in Africa and Asia. Two kinds of air collide, depending on the time of year, to the north or south of the equator. Dry, warm air drops from the northern hemisphere, and wet, warm air rises from the south. When the two kinds of air collide, they create extreme weather events. Now, we see these intensifying with the pattern of climate change. So those extreme weather events can be floods. They can be flash floods. They can be droughts, because we're certainly seeing in northern Africa a pattern of desertification, of the southern spread of the desert. So what's happening on the ground, how this impacts Africans, is in a couple of ways. First of all, those extreme floods drive people out of their homes. We are now in the world, more people are fleeing from the weather. They are what are called environmental refugees than people fleeing from war. And a lot of them live in the sand along the 10th parallel. Now, what's also true, and we see this in Sudan, but we also see this in Nigeria, is as the north of Africa gets drier and drier, it's not really possible for the people who live in North Africa, who are primarily nomadic, who have cattle and move during the times of the year, the cattle have nothing to eat anymore. And so because it's so dry, the nomads have to push farther and farther into so-called settled land, into that band along the 10th parallel where the dry north hits the wet south. Well, in general terms, the people who live in the north tend to be Muslims, and the people who live in the south are Christians. And so you have Muslims pressing into Christian land, and this is how this complicated conflict that has to do with weather, power, resources, failed government, takes on the color of religious struggle.
It's not always a case, though, where conflict is the end result. You give at least one great example in your book of where a Muslim and Christian leaders come together. And actually, and I believe that was in Nigeria, but I'm not positive on that.
That is correct.
Yeah.
In Nigeria. So the first thing I would say is, you know, I deliberately traveled to the sharpest points on this fault line. There are many places where Christians and Muslims have lived together in harmony for more than 1,000 years. But what I was looking at is the opposite. I was looking at increasing patterns of tension. And that took me to Nigeria. That took me to where we see today the Middle Belt, which we hear a lot about in the news and rarely get the context to understand what is happening in Nigeria. Now, this is important for a lot of reasons, not just because Nigeria is an oil supplier to America, but also because 1 in 7 Africans comes from Nigeria. It is the most populous nation on the continent. Now, what's happening in Nigeria in terms of Christians and Muslims happens largely in the middle of the country along that 10th parallel where the two religions meet. And more than 50,000 people have died over the past decade in conflict between Christians and Muslims fighting over land and politics in that zone. But there are at least two men who you are referring to, Pastor James and Imam Ashafa, who live in a town called Kaduna, which means crocodile, along the 10th parallel. And in that place, they have each was the leader of a former youth army in the name of religion. So the pastor was head of the Christian army, the imam was head of the Muslim army, and the two used to fight violently, so violently that in fact the pastor only has one arm because his other arm was lopped off by the imam's boys when they were fighting for control over a marketplace. The two now have brought peace to a city which was racked by such violence that Christians and Muslims actually have split up to live in different neighborhoods. And the Christian neighborhoods are called Haifa, Jerusalem, and inexplicably Television. And the Muslim neighborhoods are called Baghdad and Afghanistan. So one of the things that we see happening along the 10th parallel is the global religious identity, the links between, say, a Muslim living in Africa and a Muslim living in Baghdad are deeper than ever. And that's one of the results of globalization. And it's one of the reasons that we see spreading violence in places that have no history of violence at all.
You're listening to Eliza Griswold. She is the author of The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. Well, from Africa, you moved to Southeast Asia, particularly Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines. How do the issues in these countries differ from those you found in Africa?
They differ in large part in that the populations of Christians and Muslims in Southeast Asia are not evenly divided as they were in many of the African countries I was looking at. These are primarily, well, the Philippines is actually the only Christian country in Asia. It's a Catholic country, but it has a Muslim minority in the south that has been fighting for independence from the Catholic north since 1500. So So this is a long-seated question between Islam and Christianity in the Philippines. But in both Malaysia and Indonesia, we're looking at primarily Muslim countries with a pretty well-established Christian minority. And some of the patterns I saw happening in places where Christians were the minority is that, unfortunately, Christians bore the brunt. Christians became scapegoats for the West. Now, there are many communities in Southeast Asia that have also been Christian for a very long time, because those same patterns of weather and wind that collide in Africa are the patterns that underlie what we call the trade winds. So those wind patterns where the northern and southern hemisphere meet carried Christian and Muslim traders and missionaries by boat to the same islands, beaches, and ports during the spice trade during the 1500s. And it dates back to then when Christians and Muslims started to use religion to basically safeguard their control over trade routes. These were former crusaders arriving with crosses on their sails under Ferdinand Magellan, planting crosses on what had been Muslim land in Southeast Asia, saying, guess what, you guys are Christians now, and guess what else, we own your clothes. So money and power are underneath all of these religious conflicts. What the book really tries to do is restore the context to each of these small conflicts so that we don't overblow this kind of clash of civilizations narrative where it really doesn't apply.
You know, you're a woman, you come from an Episcopalian background, and you're American. One could argue that could be a few strikes against you when you're hanging out with some Muslims anyway. And I might add that when you were out with Franklin Graham, he was trying to get permission to proselytize for Christianity, and he was turned down by a Muslim leader. Were you in danger?
Yes, there were many, many places where I was, in fact, in danger. And you know what? I don't write about them a lot in the book, and I'll tell you why. Because this story isn't about me. This is a story about Christians and Muslims living together, trying to work out their differences in the face of global and economic pressures. And although there are places where my story is relevant because people have to understand the way I see the world in order to understand why they're reading this story in this way, which is totally subjective, the larger point is, you know what? Yes. Did I almost get killed by a mob in northern Nigeria? I did. Did I get really heavily shelled in Somalia and almost not make it out? I did. Was I okay in both situations? I was. Did they have anything to do with religious conflict? No. And so that's why they're really not
gotcha.
Too much in the book.
Well, when you're traveling across the 10th parallel, so to speak, did you approach this from the standpoint of telling people you were the reporter, or did you add the fact that your father was the former bishop of the Episcopal Church? So did you, in some cases, have to use your background in religion to maybe make some advances, or maybe in other cases, hey, I don't want to bring it up here because it's not going to work?
Well, you know, it's a problem. First of all, nobody knows what the Episcopal Church is. That's just the reality today. So it's not like a big calling card to be the daughter of the former presiding bishop. What I hadn't anticipated before I did this work is that sitting down with almost every single interview in this book, of which there are hundreds, the first question people had for me is, well, what do you believe? So although I hadn't anticipated that my own beliefs and my own understanding of God would be challenged or developed in the course of reporting this book, that's exactly what happened, simply because people were asking me. And if I was going to ask them the most intimate questions of their religion, I'd better be prepared to answer that I grew up in a Christian household and what that was like for me. And so those conversations actually ended up, for me, being some of the most meaningful reporting that I did in the book.
Well, you do say in the book that this project started, or maybe I read this someplace else, but the project started with a trip to the Sudan in 2003 with Franklin Graham. I referred to this just a moment ago, who is the son of Billy Graham. And tell us what he was trying to do and what kind of success he had. I thought this was a fascinating look into the work of evangelicals in other countries.
Yeah, Franklin Graham, Billy's son, head of a nearly billion-dollar evangelical empire now, has run some of the most powerful and successful aid missions in southern Sudan over the past now nearly three decades. Now, the thing to know about Sudan is it's one of the most complicated wars in the world. It's been going on intermittently for more than 40 years. And the sitting president of what's Northern Sudan, President Bashir, has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, for genocide, for what he did in Darfur. But long before Darfur, self-proclaimed, he waged the modern world's bloodiest jihad against people in the south of his own country, Christians and Muslims alike. And Franklin Graham really showed up and continues to show up for the people who live in South Sudan when they need protection, when they need food, when they need medical supplies. He is one of the major donors and supporters of the South. And he ran a hospital. He ran the largest hospital in the South until somewhat recently. So now Franklin Graham, at the time I traveled with him to Sudan, it was the first time he had been to Northern Sudan, and he was going to meet Bashir, a man he had called just as evil as Saddam Hussein, if not more so. So this was a pretty freighted encounter, but what Graham was doing is asking for permission to proselytize, to carry the message of Jesus Christ among Muslims in the north of the country. And Bashir chuckled and dismissed it. So he was indulging Graham with this visit, and Graham was using it for everything he could get. But it was definitely very interesting, because what happened after I left the room and learned later is that Graham remembered that he had in his pocket a George W. Bush 2004 reelection pin that he'd taken from the desk of Karl Rove's secretary. And he reached into the pocket of his blue blazer and he handed it to Bashir. And he said, "Mr. President, I understand you'll be talking to my president later today. Why don't you tell him you're his first voter here in the Sudan?" And what does that mean? For me as a reporter, that meant that faith and foreign policy were far more interlinked than we as American voters understand. And it's important today, and it's also important historically, because until fairly recently, there was no such thing as a secular human rights movement. You know, the white people who were in the Muslim world were missionaries. And so in the Muslim world, when there's an understanding that white people are in really want to spread democracy and Christianity, that's a historical example for them that was very true. And that's something we really have to understand when we think, well, why do they think we're all Christians? Why do they think we're all driving toward this religious imperialism? The truth is, in their lived experience, that is true.
Well, when you step away from your book, I really came away with the impression that if anyone were ever to theoretically attempt to remove the work of Christianity and Islam in working with people to lift them up out of their circumstances, and you said this before about the quality of the governments, given the fact that there's no alternative, there'd be an enormous void across this 10th parallel, would there not?
Absolutely. I mean, the truth is that although in isolated cases, faith has fomented problems between people, it is inherently part of the solution, because it cannot be overstated how important people's belief in God in most of what we call the global South is. It patterns people's everyday lives in a way it simply doesn't for most people walking around New York City. It's different. And that understanding of God's will and living God's will is a key to the solution of how people will coexist and how they will share limited resources. And so to think that religion is simply the problem is like an armchair view from thousands of miles away. It is also inherently part of the solution. And it's our job to help understand how that can be.
Well, that's a great lesson for all of us to learn, Eliza. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you very much for the book and for coming on Reader's Corner today to talk about it. Eliza Griswold, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Eliza Griswold. Next week, Christopher Steiner, author of Automate This: How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.